Accession number 30372, Reel 3.
So I learned, and I just sat for 4 months, and he taught me in the Russian way. He taught me in the sort of, Soviet way. I've learned all the tenses. I've learned it according to the book. It was no cards or anything. It was, I learned the words. I had to recite the vocabulary, and then I had to learn all the tenses, and I had to recite that, and I had to read so much. And I acquired Hebrew in 4 months. And then I had to do an exam, and I went to the proper class when the new school year started. And while I was, in the summer, while I was doing all these lessons, the children that I, you know, that the young, well, there were 15 and 16 year olds, I was only 9, that I got friendly with, who were sort of Romanian, mainly, I don't know why, but they just happened to be. And they used to do sexual experiments in this derelict house. And I used to be there on the door, sitting, on doing my tenses, etc., and watching that nobody grown up comes in. Now, I knew what they were doing, but I wasn't interested at all. I was just going to learn Hebrew. For a child, it was wonderful. Because it was, where we lived, there were no asphalt, there were no roads, anything. There was sand. And people, it was talking about multiculturalism, my God, you know, it was just like amazing, you know. And people lived the best they could. I mean, we lived, if my mother didn't want to go to Holon, which is like a new town, to live in a good flat, she didn't do it. She got it wrong, because all they could afford was this one room in a yard with another family in the next room, sharing a kitchen and a bathroom. Life was just rock bottom, really. There was no money. I mean, you know, we used to go for a walk on sort of Saturday, and I for ages thought that cinema is the stills that you see outside the cinema house. I never realized that you go in. I just, because there was, we never had money to go into the cinema, so I assumed that that if you go to the cinema, you just see the stills outside when they advertise it. And my mother then worked as a dressmaker. She continued, and she still used to go to people's homes, but also some people used to come to this one room that we had there. And then, and my stepfather found a job in a cable factory, but he used to work nights. And it was you see, don't forget, Jaffa at the time was Arabic and Jewish, and somebody like me, I didn't know the difference, and nobody told me, and I didn't ask. So I used to roam around with the kids, whoever they were, some of them from school and some of the ones that I met around, you know. I discovered hashish, you know, and we used to exchange cigarettes or something. I was only 10 or so, 11, you know, they used to smoke cigarettes, and I used to smoke. Which was very funny later, because when, much later, I was offered a cigarette, you know, it maybe when I was at school, maybe 13 or 14, and I tried it, I said, this isn't a cigarette. I don't know what it is, but it's definitely not a cigarette. So they said, what do you mean not a cigarette? Anyway, I then said, I'll get you a real cigarette. And I brought all these joints to school and told kids that this was a real cigarette. I can't tell you. I was discovered because they told the teacher. I had this, you know. And, I mean, you know, I had such hiding from my mother. I was, you know. And that's where they insisted that we have to leave Jaffa and move to Tel Aviv, because they thought that I had too many influences that were very undesirable. Yes, only because I got to this very smart school. It was one of the new schools. It was a high school by then, and it was very, very, very new, very modern, and it was considered one of the best schools in Tel Aviv. And it drafted a tremendous amount of top of the Tel Aviv population in. And I suddenly came in contact with people, children of professional people who were born and bred in Israel in a very middle class. That was my middle class. But the life in Jaffa was, I mean, I learned to swim in an irrigation pool with some Arab boys. I mean, if my mother ever knew. This is where I also learned to lie, because I realized that there is life in Israel that if I tell her about, she just would not allow me to have. So I learned to keep stuff to myself, more so. I always did a bit, but more so. And I used to go to the beach and learn to swim, and I used to be very daring. I used to go in on a tire, you know, using a tire to sort of, before I could swim. And I used to roam free, and I used to not come home, and she never knew where I was. And we had awful scenes of anger and smacking, and I was really beaten up really badly by her. My stepfather was always very, he tried to protect me, but he couldn't, because he didn't. But he didn't think it's right, I knew that. When I was 9, and I went to this class, this Israeli class at school, I met a girl who was called, who is still a friend of mine, we're still very friendly, Daniela Avrahami. And her family became my role model. And once I actually found what life I want, then suddenly my life at home seemed less important. They were a Bulgarian family, who the father was a doctor and the mother was, I think she was a chemist, and he was an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and he was, and they lived in Yafo as well, in Jaffa. He had a clinic at home. They had no money or anything, but they were, and there was a grandmother, and they had, and they grew herbs, and they had Hebrew lessons. And they had bicycles when they used to go in the area to learn to get to know the area. And they supervised her books, her reading, and they had a piano, and she learned to play the piano. And once I was invited there for lunch, and on the table there were all these vegetables, and there was a pie, and there was a cassoulet, and then the grandmother used to dish it onto everybody's plate, and there was a discussion. And I thought, this is what I want. And I loved the food. Absolutely loved it. And it was not just Bulgarian, but it was also Israeli. Now, we at home ate Polish food. You can't imagine what it's like to have a hot chicken soup in 32 centigrade. You just, you know. And boiled potatoes in when you come back from a beach. You can't imagine what it's like. Our circumstances, their circumstances, this family, you know, they were poor, they weren't rich or anything. You know, they had no money, but they were professional middle class. So they were going to get there. But their life was positive. And they were what I wanted, where I wanted to be. And my parents, they weren't there. So I left them behind. And it didn't bother me. So my relationship with my mother was just off, you know, that's what there is, but I shouldn't worry about it because, it, you know, I've got a life of my own, I've got my own dreams, I've got, and I don't have to worry about it. And so she couldn't get to me. And that's how it was till I was 17. Well, at 17, I was 17 and a half when I finished high school and I went to the army. And I actually went to the Nahal and to a kibbutz. And, you know, and there was horrible rows about it. I can't tell you, horrible rows about it. She would not accept. She wanted me to be... A townie. She wanted me to be a townie Polish, you know, just dumb, blonde. And I was short, stocky, curly black hair, and I didn't look good in stilettos. I looked horrible. She tried and tried, and she used to put me in these awful dresses and matching handbags, all in beige, and I looked horrible, you know. And I didn't walk right for it. I didn't, you know, talk right for it. She used to try to match me with those Polish, you know, guys who sort of, you know, wore suits, and I used to just die to be seen if anybody saw me walking with them to the cinema on the occasions I did. So beforehand, so I used to belong to the scouts, you know, and I used to go, and there were fights. There were absolute fights on every trip or everywhere I had to go that was very Israeli. I mean, I went, when I was young, I went to Eilat, which was, you know, like hitchhiking with a friend to Eilat. And when I came back, all covered in the white sand, etc., I told her that I sort of been to Tel Aviv on the beach for 3 days, you know, sleeping at some friend's aunt or something. You know. She didn't know where Eilat was, so it didn't matter. I could tell her anything. You know, I could, you know. And I did. Well, when I went to the army, I went to the kibbutz, and I loved it. I loved the kibbutz. I went to Sde Boker. I was very unfortunate. I was in Sde Boker when Ben Gurion was there. So there I was, sitting in the evening, listening to the Prime Minister of Israel, and his wife Paula teaching me how to clean windows because I wasn't very good at that. And talking politics and talking socialism and talking about you know history and listening to very sophisticated stuff. By then I was miles away from my parents mentally and physically, and I remember one day they came to visit, and there was a sandstorm. It was very unfortunate. And they came in the bus, they got down, they look around, and my stepfather, who was a great town, he looked at his shoes getting covered in sand, and he said to my mother, before the bus goes, we go back. that was their visit to where I was. There was absolutely nothing we had in common at all. Because I became an Israeli, but also because I became not just an Israeli, I became a socialist. I became a communist. Because I just, you know, we were miles apart. I thought he was wonderful. I learned later about maybe, you know, at the time, I just cherished that time. I cherished those evenings when I heard him talk. I cherished his dedication to Zionism at the time. I mean, I have no argument about it. I do. I'm really upset about what's going on in Israel, but I could not deny Zionism because it saved me. It made me, you know. Maybe if I went to America, it would be the same. But I don't think so. I think I actually wiped out all my time during the war in Poland through becoming rooted in Israel. Because I still work there, because I still go there every year to work, a friend of mine, an English, you know, a British friend, came with me because she was going on some, you know, to one of the demonstrating around the checkpoint. She came with me to Israel, and then when we came back, she said to me how interesting it was. I've changed. I fitted. I really fitted there. She suddenly realized how maybe I'm still foreign here. I considered myself Israeli, but I'd find it difficult because, you know, I can see two sides. The most liberal Israelis that I know, and I do know a lot of very liberal Israelis, when you take an argument to its essence, they will always say, but it's not just us, it's them too. And I wouldn't say that, because I can see it from outside. Because I see that it's not just about bartering, it's about the injustice of depositioning people, uprooting people. There is an injustice in it, and that injustice was done, and it's not us, it's them too. The Israelis still would say, they will still justify what's happening. I can't justify it anymore. I think that maybe a state of Israel has got to find a better way to exist, to coexist. Maybe they should have thought about it earlier, with their history, that you can't throw people out from where they are, just because you were given a permission to be there.
But you were thrown out.
That's why they shouldn't have done it. That's why at 17, already, I didn't believe it, that it was right.
How do you feel when an Israeli would say, why should we be more moral than the others? Why, you are ascribing Jews a higher morality than the rest of the world, aren't you?
Because, on the other hand, they always believe they're the chosen people.
Mm-hmm.
They do.
then you don't.
Possibly, but I don't believe that either. You see, I think that there is that rightly or wrongly, and maybe on the other hand, per capita, you would say that the Jews did always very well in the professional and the philosophical global society per capita, if you think about it. And I think that we are an old race that knows a lot about hardship. And maybe we should be a bit more careful in the 20th century than we were. I left Israel for good in 1966. I left at 62 because I had a sort of a bit of a crisis. But I didn't leave Israel. I came to London to study. I had a problem in the kibbutz because I wasn't an agriculture person. I liked the kibbutz for its social stance, and I like the life. I stand by it even today. I think that if you have an agenda, and if you're female, the kibbutz gives you a tremendous opportunity, which life nowhere else does. You know, it does. You know, it does do it for you. You know, it gives you the chance to be more than just a childminder and a housewife. And I think it's still true today. The fact that most people don't take it is another story. But, you know, if you want. It also gives that opportunity to people, to men, you know, to either gender. But at the time, to me as a female, it was more important. But the kibbutz did not, particularly Zdeboker at the time, would not allow me to study no art or graphic design or anything. And I had interests like that. I had an uncle who supported me very much, who was very important at the time in my life. But, And I wasn't going to be bullied by the kibbutz. So I had to leave and go to study. And I was accepted to Bezalel. And I was in Jerusalem. And I couldn't find myself. I missed the kibbutz socially. Didn't know. And this was the time where my mother stepped in with all her dresses and stiletto heels and things, and I was such a loss that I tried it on for it. And it was horrible. It was really a complete dead loss. But then my stepfather said to me, look, I've got some money from Germany. Why don't you take it? Go to England or somewhere and, you know, see what it's like. And, I mean, it was wonderful, you know. And I came to England because I spoke English. I mean, already by then, I mean, I was very much into English literature. I was very much into film. I was very, you know, the going to the high school to that. I mean, basically, I became middle class. I got totally absorbed in the Israeli society and in the people who I know now, who all are wonderfully successful elders of Israel now, you know. I mean, they're just amazing. I'm still friendly with them when I go there. And they're great people. They had great professional time. They had great, you know, jobs, and they did very well. And, you know, I'm really pleased for them. I was really pleased that I met them at the time. So everything was great, fine, turned up really good. But so I came to London, and I loved London because I suppose because I was away from my mother. And my husband, Robin, always says that Israel was too small for me and my mother. You know. And I was here on my own. I immediately deposited the whole suitcase at Oxfam, which was my total liberation, and bought myself a black jumper and black trousers at Marks & Spencer's, and became a beatnik. And I loved it. And I loved the college here. And I had a very good time. And I had absolutely no money in the first year, but in the second year, I got a grant from the British Council, and I got a grant from his, George Him, who was a Brit, who actually had a lot of, was Jewish, and he had a lot of, he was a designer. He sort of helped me to also get a grant from the Israeli Education Department. So suddenly I had more money, and I had a better life. And I met a colleague, you know, at school, a student, was Robin, and we got friendly, became my boyfriend. And I took him to Israel in 64. And I never saw that somebody might not like Israel. I was blind. I assumed that he'd love it, and then in 65 we got married, and we were going to be here for 2 years, and then we were going to Israel, and it was obvious. And because he was English, he missed to tell me he doesn't want to go. He never did say that. So we went, and it was a complete disaster. For a year and a half. And I think this was really, I think it was very difficult for me. I think possibly it was the most difficult part of my life, this period. Because it was the beginning of the Six-Day War, and he just was not going to take it at all. And he went to, it's not that he wasn't willing, he hated Israel, he didn't like all the, you know, he kept on saying, you know, I'm not getting on the bus, it's not a question of life and death, and everybody was shouting, and it was so loud, everybody was so intense. We did well financially. I mean, we lived in Dizengoff in Tel Aviv, because I had friends. I mean, I was very, yeah, I had the right friends. I was in the right society. I organized teaching jobs for us in Betzalel. And we had a freelance practice, and we did quite well. And we worked for Elal. And, you know, the whole, you know. We had a very, very good time. And my parents were in absolute pain. I mean, they used to come and bring us this food. And they used to look at our fridge and I found them, and they wanted us to come every Saturday for lunch, and we wanted to be on the beach, and, you know, it's just they wanted to rein me in into their life, and their life was something I spent years to get away from. And I think that I am now so much more sympathetic to my mother. She died in 87. Only now I can look at her and think, couldn't I have given her a little bit more support? But I couldn't. I couldn't. At the time, I couldn't. It took all my energy to get away from their life and to build one for myself with ideals and intellectually, emotionally, and economically. And all the time, my model was Daniela and her family.